Today, solve the housing crisis by building smaller, darker, and higher homes. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, from the latest post covering finance and property news. Housing affordability is one of the biggest pressures facing the Australian community, and the government has committed to building 1.2 million new, quote, well-located homes across Australia by the middle of 2029. This is all but impossible, of course, on current trends, and, of course, housing pressures have been exacerbated by super high migration. Historically, housing construction across Australia has been strongly correlated with the level of interest rates and broader macroeconomic conditions. As a result, the level of housing construction tends to rise and fall in a similar pattern across the states and territories over time. And housing delivery is cyclical and is currently in a downturn across Australia. In fact, under the National Housing Accord, New South Wales is to build 377,000 well-located homes in just 5 years. So the question is this even possible? Well, the New South Wales Productivity and Equality Commission just released a report, Review of Housing Supply Challenges and Policy Options for New South Wales. The New South Wales Productivity and Equality Commission's recommendations only become government policy if they're explicitly adopted or actioned by the government, and the New South Wales government may adopt or implement recommendations wholly, in part, or in a modified form. But in this final report, first, it rightly shows that momentum in the construction of homes has wilted in recent years. The report says despite the need for more well-located homes, new dwelling completions have fallen in recent years. New South Wales built close to 75,000 new homes in 2018, but as of March 2024, the rate of annual completions has fallen 40% to just over 45,000. That means the rate of build is well below that required to meet the federal government target. Most housing in New South Wales is built by the private sector, and builders and developers need to earn a profit for a project to be commercially viable. The higher the potential profit, the more likely a development will be feasible and go ahead. The cost of delivering new homes in New South Wales has increased significantly over the past 5 years. They presented some indicative estimates that may not reflect different development conditions across the state, including in regional New South Wales, which also faces housing supply and affordability issues. Nevertheless, they show that the cost of delivering a new apartment in a typical mid-rise apartment block in Sydney has increased from $666,000 back in 2018 to $905,000 in 2023. That's an increase of $239,000 or 36%. This is reflected in increased construction costs, which is the single largest cost of development, and has lifted by 29%, driven by significantly higher prices of raw materials such as steel and timber. Also, financing costs, which have more than doubled since 2018, to around $83,000 per apartment, reflecting the large increase in interest rates over the period. Then there's land acquisition costs, which have increased by about 50% since 2018 to around $150,000 per apartment, reflecting the longer-term trend towards higher land prices as well-located land becomes increasingly scarce. And then there's the risk and the need to meet required margins. Residential developers typically need to demonstrate they can achieve a profit margin of around 18% to attract financing and to compensate investors for the risks. In fact, since 2018, this has increased noticeably in absolute terms, reflecting elevated levels of risk in the construction and development industries. No surprise then that home building in New South Wales has slowed recently as developers' costs have risen faster than the price they can receive for selling new homes. This squeezes their profit margins, making them less likely to proceed with new projects. Developers are not able to recover the required 18% margin. Why 18%, you might ask? Well, they say developers typically require a higher profit margin than other types of businesses because developments are large and complex projects. When things go wrong, developers face significant risks and costs. If the return is not high enough to offset those risks, developers will simply invest in other, less risky activities. And as we know, insolvencies in building and construction has risen. In fact, in New South Wales, 1,400 fell over in the past year. That's a record. Actually, whilst residential development is subdued across Australia, the construction sector as a whole is not. The NAB Quarterly Business Survey suggests capacity utilisation in Australia's construction sector is elevated compared both to the past and to the economy as a whole. The major reason the construction sector is struggling to deliver homes across Australia is because Australian governments are diverting resources away from home building and towards public infrastructure projects. Commonwealth, state and territory governments have made immense commitments and are spending heavily on major infrastructure. They have been for the last 15 years. This includes investments in metropolitan rail networks, new light rail lines, urban motorways, energy projects, broadband technology, and regional road, rail, and water projects, with New South Wales leading the way. Housing construction, therefore, is getting crowded out. Now, according to the report, high-density housing plays a crucial role in accommodating growing populations in urban areas and providing affordable and accessible housing to a diverse population. However, approvals for higher-density homes, like apartments, have fallen by over 50% since their peak in 2016. At the same time, the average completion time for new apartments has increased from around 22 months in 2015 to 30 months in 2023. Building approvals point to further challenges in the period ahead. The current annualised level of approvals in the June quarter of 2024 was around 42,000 dwellings, only a little over half the National Housing Accord's aspirational target of 75,300 new homes per year in New South Wales. This suggests dwelling completions will remain low over the coming year. So what should be done to address the significant shortfall? Well, some stakeholders have suggested the New South Wales government should deliver private housing itself and simply waive some of the profit margin that private sector developers require. This would reduce the cost of development and therefore increase its feasibility. In this scenario, the government could direct Landcom, Homes New South Wales, or another government-owned developer to develop housing projects that are just about feasible for the private sector to deliver. This would involve taking on projects where the expected profit margin is slightly below the required minimum of around 18% that is typically required for developers to secure financing. This approach could have some benefits. It would avoid the dilemma of having to incentivize private developers to pursue marginally unfeasible projects. And the government could also pursue projects that have wider social benefits, such as integrating social housing with private market housing. But, they say, this approach to boosting supply has limitations, particularly in the short term. Without the competitive incentives to drive efficiency, there's always risk that government housing projects will be more costly to develop than their equivalent private developments. And when the construction sector is at capacity, large-scale delivery of housing by the public sector can also crowd out private sector housing delivery, offsetting the desired increase in housing supply, and compete with other public sector construction projects for scarce labour and materials, causing cost overruns across the sector. Having said that, they say, the Commission does support a sustained long-term increase in social housing delivery over the long term. Well, then, could buy-to-rent be a potential solution to boosting Australia's supply of housing? Build-to-rent projects typically involve large housing developments of 50 or more dwellings built with the aim of being held long-term by a corporate owner, like a superannuation fund for rental purposes. Build-to-rent can be attractive to institutional investors seeking a stable long-term income stream and to people seeking stable long-term rental accommodation with professional management. Actually, the share of housing in Australia that is built-to-rent is relatively low by international standards. This reflects some barriers which institutional investors face, including higher land tax rates for larger land holdings and difficulties in obtaining debt funding due to the risk associated with large upfront development and construction costs, which can only be repaid progressively once rental income is received. The New South Wales and federal government already provide or intend to provide a variety of tax and planning concessions to encourage more built-to-rent housing. In fact, the NSW government also announced funding in the 24-25 budget for Landcom to develop a number of built-to-rent projects. Stakeholders that support built-to-rent have suggested it could be used to improve housing supply and affordability while making the housing supply cycle more stable and responsive. The Commission, though, believes built-to-rent does have a valuable role to play in the Australian housing market, but in considering the international and domestic experience with build-to-rent, it has not found strong evidence to suggest that governments should favour build-to-rent over other kinds of housing. And by the way, other research shows that the costs of living in those properties tend to be higher because the rents are higher. In general, there is a risk that measures to encourage build-to-rent developments will simply substitute one form of ownership for another without materially improving housing supply or affordability. So, what about better use of existing housing stock then? Building new housing is only one way to increase housing supply. Another opportunity is to use existing stock of housing more efficiently. Some estimates suggest there are around 15,000 vacant dwellings in New South Wales. Other dwellings may also be underutilised, for instance, where a home has more rooms than the household requires. There are a number of potential ways the Commonwealth, state or territory governments could encourage more efficient use of existing housing stock. This includes incentivizing homeowners to rent out spare bedrooms by providing tax relief on rental income up to a certain threshold. That's similar to the rent-to-room scheme used in the UK. Allowing student accommodation to be used for other purposes when not used by students, such as for short-term rental accommodation for holidaymakers during the summer months, and changing the way the family home is treated in the age pension asset test and or for the purposes of determining the age pension rate to encourage empty nesters to downsize. Efficient policy interventions that encourage long-term rentals over short-term rental agreements are also worth looking at. A statewide regulatory framework for the short-term rentals was introduced in 2021, which mandates all short-term rents to be registered with the Registrar in New South Wales. New South Wales government is currently reviewing the existing regulatory framework and considering options to encourage the supply of long-term rental accommodation, including revenue measures. So, given all of that, they then turn to the old faithfuls of revised planning rules. Peter Tulip would love this. The New South Wales government has identified 8 priority high-growth areas near transport hubs in Greater Sydney for accelerated rezoning. Rezoning around those transport hubs will create capacity for up to 61,855 new homes over 15 years within walking distance of those key stations. The government has also amended planning controls within 400 metres of 37 stations to deliver more affordable, well-designed and well-located homes. However, the analysis suggests that the planning system is still blocking density in many areas where it would be highly profitable to deliver, such as Waverley and Ku-ring-gai. By contrast, the planning system has tended to allow more development in areas where feasibility is low or marginal, such as Liverpool, the Hills and Blacktown. This has made residential development in Sydney more vulnerable to cyclical downturns and is more easily crowded out by other types of construction that offer higher profits. So to accelerate housing supply, they say the New South Wales government should relax feasibility blockers in the planning system and allow more density in the more feasible locations, especially those with existing infrastructure capacity. For example, the recent completion of the Sydney Metro City has freed up substantial capacity on the existing Sydney Trains T9 Northern Line, expanding the provisions to allow more dense residential development around Artarmon, Wollstonecraft and Waverton stations will take advantage of this new infrastructure capacity. And they also want to accelerate planning approval processes. The NSW government should also investigate and prioritise other planning relaxations that boost feasibility the most and which are easiest and fastest implement. As it takes several years to build a new home, planning reforms that implement earlier stages of the development process take longer to show their benefits. High-impact reforms could be combined with reforms whose benefits will be felt more quickly. There are opportunities to target reforms towards the latter stages in the development process to boost feasibility and delivery faster, for example, by allowing and fast-tracking requests to add extra floors to apartment DAs for an existing approval. Focusing on high feasibility areas also has the benefit of allowing more homes where people want to live while discouraging urban sprawl and land banking. That also often includes swifter approvals for infill development. And the killer recommendation is to relax design requirements that limit choice and supply, they say. Currently, the threshold at which residential developments can be subject to a design review panel or design competition can be very low. For example, the height threshold for reference to a local design panel, it's just 3 stories, and the dwelling threshold is just 4 dwellings. These thresholds seem to contemplate a sprawling low-rise city where building up is unusual. They are not suited to New South Wales' mission of delivering abundant, well-located and well-designed homes through medium and high-rise development around transport hubs. So they recommend relaxing the apartment design guide and expand the approach of using guides to promote quality design while overriding restrictive controls. Relaxing car parking requirements can also significantly boost feasibility. Parking requirements are a major component of development costs for a typical new high-rise apartment. They estimate around $93,000 or one-fifth of construction costs. While many households will continue to want parking on title, others access to shared or commercial parking, public transport or car share schemes will better meet their needs. For those households, having to purchase or rent a parking lot with their home represents an unnecessary expense. For some, it could put homeownership out of reach, they say. Now, they do briefly discuss the question of on-street parking and congestion and suggest that the New South Wales government should investigate models that separate parking ownership from home ownership in high-density mixed-use areas. I have to say, it feels like more people parking on the streets and more congestion. Then they suggest that they should remove the minimum apartment sizes to build more homes with less resources. Similarly, minimum balcony sizes, storage requirements, and requirements to include larger bedrooms in family-sized units all regulate clearly observable characteristics. Consumers are well placed, they say, to decide which of those features they are willing to pay for and which are worth foregoing to live in a more attractive location. Those requirements should be removed, they say. In other words, let consumers decide, and also let consumers decide how much solar access they want to pay for. Currently, a certain percentage of apartments in the building must receive direct sunlight in order to meet guidelines. Solar access requirements limit the ability to build apartments close to each other, which reduces the number of apartments that can be built in desirable locations. Solar access requirements are at odds, they say, with Australia's and the New South Wales government's national goal of building more well-located homes. Many prospective buyers are happy to live in a home with less solar access if it means homes are more affordable in their desired neighbourhood. Now, it's unclear why regulations should take this choice away, they say. Consumers are well placed to choose how much solar access they are willing to pay for. And finally, on building standards, New South Wales governments adopted higher energy efficiency standards in October 2023 through enhanced basics requirements, which apply only to new dwellings. In fact, stakeholders have suggested that homeowners brought forward new home purchases to September 2023 to avoid paying the higher costs. And so they suggest that building codes don't always balance quality with cost and feasibility. Oh, and to tie the ribbon on the report, Build Skills Australia estimates that Australia requires an additional 90,000 residential building workers to meet the overall National Housing Accord target of those 1.2 million new well-located homes over 5 years. Just based on New South Wales' share of the national population, the state's construction workforce would need to expand by around 30,000 workers if the overall national target is to be met. The construction industry in New South Wales accounts for 9.4% of the state's workforce. Over the last 3 years, employment growth in the construction industry outpaced that of New South Wales' overall workforce, and in May 2024, the construction industry overtook the retail trade industry to be the third largest industry by employment in New South Wales, employing around 420,000 people. So, they table recommendations from training, access to interstate labour, and of course, skilled migration. And they discuss the adoption of modern methods of construction and also regulation in the housing mix. So, in summary, New South Wales needs to build 377,000 homes by the middle of 2029 under its housing targets. The Productivity and Equality Commission recommended higher density zones around train stations should double in size and extend further into Sydney's eastern suburbs and the North Shore. And they are also recommending design standards be relaxed to allow the construction of smaller apartments without access to parking, storage, or direct sunlight. And they say government spending priorities should shift from infrastructure projects like new metros and motorways to projects that support rapid housing supply. Oh, and there would be more migration opportunities for construction workers to address a critical skills shortage. Even then, I suspect targets won't be met. But for me, by not talking about the demand side of the equation, driven by too high a migration, they are missing the elephant in the room. As a result, they are proposing we build higher, smaller, darker homes as high-rise living is forced more widely on the population. This risks further degrading the standards of living for many. True, while some may be willing to pay less to get anything to live in, the trade-off and compromises are enormous. Actually, I think the Commission is driven by the neoliberal philosophy, let the market rip. It's blind to the migration question. I wonder why, perhaps something to do with the terms of reference. And so this report needs to be taken with a truckload of salt. Let's hope it's not blindly followed, as it's a road to small, dark living for many. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.